Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is supported by Bon Bon, a charming neighborhood bistro in Lawrence, Kansas, serving eclectic cuisine with Midwest roots.
This week on a special bonus episode of Meat in 3, we find out why the bacon, egg, and cheese, that classic bodega sandwich, is popping up on menus of New York's trendiest restaurants.
We did a few iterations of it, and I was trying to fancify it. We tried the sausage, egg, and cheese, and then we tried to put shamula sauce on it. We used feta cheese, and we just like taking ingredients of the Mediterranean, if you will, and try to infuse it. But for me, it was like a car wreck.
Tune in to hear about the wild journey of the bacon, egg, and cheese, from deli to fine dining, on Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning. Thanks, Matt, for, I think, extending our opening just a bit as we were laughing here in the studio. Today is Thursday, October 24th. This is the Main Course OG. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here in the studio with some of my favorite people. I've got all my co-hosts in the room. Patrick Martins.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
Good
full house today.
Very full house. I'm really excited. We also have Mike Edison.
Hey.
Hey, hey. And Brandon Hoy.
We're Mike and I are trying to figure out how to get this wacky sound machine to work.
Oh, yeah, we're all looking forward to when that happens.
It's exciting. It adds excitement.
And?
All right. We also have some really special guests who we will do proper intros for later, but we've got Daniel Sharp and James Wetlore.
Hello.
This week.
See how exciting that is?
We're going to jump right into our word association.
Well, no, actually, okay, fine. I just wanted to say congratulations. Mike just published a book, Sympathy for the Drummer. Brandon got an official copy. Not sure what happened for the rest of us.
Well, I'm on the list. I don't know if you guys are on Mike Edison's list. And it's a very difficult list to get onto.
The quick way to get on the list is to offer to throw me a pizza party in celebration of my book. That is definitely fast-tracking it. So we will be having the totally unauthorized Charlie Watts pizza party here at Roberta's on November 7th, Thursday.
And in the book, it tells you how much Charlie loves pizza, right?
That's
there's a whole chapter of...
That's basically the gist of the whole thing.
All right. And in other events... Tonight, Team Heritage and James and Mike and a bunch of friends are hanging at Burano here in Williamsburg at 26 Broadway. We are doing a Goat-tober celebration. Cesare Casella is slicing some prosciutto. There's some happy hour specials. Anyone listening live, we hope you come and join us. And tomorrow, we are doing a free event at Saxelby Cheesemongers. Daniel has made some awesome goat meatballs that are currently under some secret dry rub.
I'm going to go pull it today. To pull all the meat off the bone.
I know. Are you prepared with a hairnet, a beard guard?
No, but I washed my hands this morning.
Oh, fantastic.
Finally.
Yeah. But Anne is providing some goat cheeses. Omegang Brewery is pouring beer. We're really excited. So it's free. Join us 5 to 8 p.m. Friday,
Basement,
October 25th.
Chelsea Market.
Correct.
And an international award is being given out to a slaughterhouse owner. And a national award is being given out to the International Goat-tober Person of the Year.
What is a national award? Versus a...
It's being given domestically by a domestic...
You don't know about domestic awards?
Well, I don't understand why the one for the slaughterhouse is international and why the one for James is national.
James should give the humblest of awards to the person who is so often overlooked, the abattoir.
Speaking of awards, no one's going to congratulate me.
Chicago?
Fine, then.
Michelin?
Oh, yeah. Two stars, Blanca. Oh, my God. That's amazing. You maintained two.
Maintained.
Congratulations.
I feel like maintaining might be harder than getting sometimes.
Absolutely.
October is a really, really, really big food month, especially in New York and around the world. That's so exciting. Did you go to the party?
Have I ever gone to any party?
Well, I don't know.
It's been many years.
The Michelin Tire Man was at this party. I thought you might have gone.
I heard. How amazing is that? How old
is
the Michelin?
There is actually a Michelin Tire.
Are you sure it wasn't the Marshmallow Man from
Garth? Yeah, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. I love that.
No, this one had some ribbing. He walks with the tire. I'm pretty sure he was there.
First of all, when you say he has some ribbing, it's like I just imagine him as a giant condom. It's disgusting.
Is there a snow version of him, like covered in chains?
Yes, there is the snow tire. Absolutely. Okay, we love this new game, Word Association. We are going to jump in. Our co-host, Mike Edison. Remember, this is 10 words or less, fast-paced.
I have not looked at the cheat sheet.
Your word is institutionalized.
Patrick Martin's.
So you must be meaning mental institution.
Institutionalized.
My other co-host, Brandon Hoy, your word is consolidation.
I don't even know what that means.
You're consolidating Roberta's right now. You're moving everything to this block from Pfizer.
That was where we were going with this.
My answer is Patrick Martin's.
Fantastic. Daniel Sharp, executive chef of the Meatball Shop. Your word is franchising.
Really misunderstood word. Nobody knows what it means.
He's like, I'm going to explain to you why you shouldn't have put that word for me in the meatball shop.
We're not a franchise.
I didn't think so. Patrick chose that one.
But what is it called when one restaurant opens many different places and there's a chef at each place?
Multiple.
Multiple locations. Franchising is...
Now, where's my sound effect now?
Franchising is when there's ownership. You know, there's people buy in. They open a chain or a anyway. Moving on. Yeah. And the man in the room with the English accent, who's been touring the world this month, celebrating Goat-tober, James Wetlore of Cabrito Goat Meat in the UK. Your word is branding.
I thought about cattle, where you're branding.
Oh. Oh, nice.
I realize now that I should probably.
That's me. A man.
Do you brand
answer.
Goats?
No.
They get a tag.
They get an ear tag in each ear. Hmm.
So, by the way, guys, we launched Goat-tober here in the States. Aaron Fairbanks and Ann Saxelby came up with the idea, but we were chugging along at a slow snail's pace. Then this guy comes where there's a lot of goats being killed. 2 million goats are being euthanized a year, male goats, in England.
In Europe.
And he is fighting to keep those goats alive, to live their life. It is amazing how much more they have goat culture there. We have no goat culture.
It's all because of the French. Yeah. French eat a lot of goat's cheese. They've exported that.
You're the goat, what is it, Pied Piper, St. Peter. You're the one, like, saving male goats. It's amazing.
Well, that's kind of the idea.
Leading them off the cliff.
Straight into
Purdy's. Well, they die anyway, but they deserve the dignity of living a life. Euthanizing babies, that's totally unacceptable.
You can't have a food system based on a 50% mortality rate.
Yeah. That's basically what it is.
We did a staff talk yesterday with Marta, and I was brief, and I let James do most of the talking, and you should have just, everyone was like silent and shocked when he basically explained that 50% is just, it's garbage.
And it's the thing about that is that in any other farming system, that farming system would be closed down at a 50% mortality rate.
Yeah. They would go to jail.
But we tolerate it because there is a demand for the
goat
dairy
products.
Right, but goats are eaten all over the world. I mean, Americans don't really have a taste for it for whatever reason.
Western diet doesn't have any culture history, but across a global basis, goat is
the most popular.
Yeah, well that Western diet, like Australia, Europe, the western part of the US, there is no cultural history, and that's all to do with the wool trade 1,000 years ago in the UK. But that's probably a bit too dorky for your listeners.
God, you can be such a nerd when it comes to goats.
Totally. Absolutely.
Although
that's a product, and as you know, I'm sure having just written a book, you can really go down some rabbit holes late at night when you're researching books.
Yeah. Researching goats?
Yeah, well, that's what I was doing. Reading PhDs from guys in Bilbao who have traced, like, trade routes via goat DNA. You're like, I really need to go to bed.
I think goats were the smartest livestock by far, and they figured out a way to not get eaten. Although you say it's widely popular, it's not the most consumed meat. It's just the most consumed meat over the biggest amount of territory.
They were the first domesticated farm animal. So dogs were the first domesticated animal, but the first farm animal was goats.
What were goats when they were wild? Just those wild goats we see on the cliffs?
Yeah. Well, and that's one of their problems in terms of turning them into meat animals in a Western context, is they've never had any of that selective breeding that they've turned the animals that we have now from wild animals into meat animals. So they have all those disadvantages.
Well, that was a good word association.
You've always told me they have weak feet. Does that have something to do with being domesticated?
Yeah, because they've evolved.
They can't run away.
But I've seen them on trampolines and pajamas and stuff.
And yoga classes.
You have a little gif on your phone, don't you? They just jump. All right, so I'm going to segue to another, you know, sort of British topic here.
Hot topic?
Yeah. Do you want to do the whole show
in a British accent?
Yeah, can you do the whole question in a British accent?
This is great.
When Meghan Markle. No.
This is great. So it's like hanging out with John Cleese.
Breaking news, Patrick is English.
Breaking news, Patrick speaks English.
So when Meghan Markle's life is at its worst, as it seems it has been, and her face is plastered across all the British tabloids, what food would you make her to brighten her day? Perhaps the greatest comfort food of all time.
White Castle, obviously.
Great. So that'll
Chef
be popular.
Daniel Sharp?
I think, the fact that she's in England, she has access to one of the greatest comfort dishes of all time, which is a shepherd's pie.
Oh, shepherd's
pie. That is like a warm down comforter of a comfort food. I just want to crawl underneath the layer of mashed potatoes.
I could be on the North Pole. I pull that blanket over me and I'll be fine.
I know. It is like the heroine of foods.
She also looks like she could crush like a whole casserole dish of lasagna.
I can just see it in her eyes.
She's like Garfield. She's just like sitting, like laying on the floor waiting for lasagna.
By the light of the fridge, like 4 a.m, crying tears of joy. There's tears
with her. What's she very upset? She's in the news. That's why we bring her up.
Patrick would like you all to know she's upset because no one took the time to ask her how she's doing.
No, she came out on the news. They got interviewed. She's getting buddy hatcheted by the English media.
They followed her.
I believe they're moving to America. Is this the news?
Is that the news?
I don't know. This is more like TMZ gossip that I'm hearing. But
they're going to pretend to be commoners and then make friends and then later reveal that they're royalty, kind of like the movie Coming to America.
Great movie.
I hope Meghan Markle moved
to Queens.
Yeah, and open up like a Mac.
I don't think Prince Harry's going to be mopping floors in McDonald's.
No, she doesn't really seem like she's cut quite from that cloth, does she?
I mean, she's like LA celeb. She came from being a movie star to now being a royal. But anyway, they did this piece and they followed them to Africa and they did a full documentary. And the journalist said, "Has anyone actually asked how you're doing through all of this?" And she got all teary and she said, "You're the first person to ask. Thank you so much."
People are like, "Hi, how are you?" That's the most normal way of saying hello.
Patrick and I were talking.
"Hi, how are you?"
Patrick and I were talking yesterday. The British tabloids are much more, I think, scarring for people.
Aggressive?
Yeah, because our tabloids, I don't think anybody reads them except people waiting at the supermarket checkout line. I would beg to differ.
First of all, I listen to a lot of New York sports radio, and like everyone who calls in believe, like they just read the tabloids.
Yes, my little left-wing elitist. Let me tell you something. Most of America is standing in line at those very places to which you refer. So you may not be reading it, but this is a very big country.
What do you mean? When I travel with Patrick, he buys every single weekly magazine.
Jennifer Aniston gets fan mail. Congratulations on your triplets. You know, I hope they can disconnect them one day.
Exactly. All right. So what, James? What are you going to feed her? Do you have what's the?
There's so much comfort food. Like it's really hard to choose one because there is so much. I mean, I would probably something pastry with guanciale in it. Maybe like a.
Carbonara,
and then I also thought about pizza, and I also thought about a tub of Ben and Jerry's chocolate brownie ice cream. So.
All right, as you guys said, she looks like she could eat a lot, right? That's what Brandon is going to stick with that answer.
She looks like she could make love to a bottle of tequila. That's what she really needs.
Do most women look like that to you?
I think you just got to look really deep into their eyes, and you'll find it in almost anyone, not just women. You're just really deep into their eyes. I see it in you, too.
That is a terrifying look you're giving me there.
All right. Patrick told me I'm allowed to tell everyone. He used Uber Eats for fast food this week for the first time. I don't even think you know how to call an Uber, but you learned how to call Uber Eats.
I will only do takeout from restaurants where I can call the person there, like Chinese restaurants, pizza places, or really cool restaurants. Hey, what's up? What do you got?
So you guys know how annoying Patrick is.
He
always asks for the owner too. So when he calls, he's like, "Lynn, may I talk to Mrs.? I need to talk.
I'm her friend."
Yeah. So what did you get? He's got to get straight to the owner. He'll wait another hour before he can speak to the owner.
I'm like, "I'll keep the kids up." Tell her to call me.
So what did you order? Was it McDonald's?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. The kids love it. Basically, or was it McDonald's?
It was. I spent $40 on McDonald's somehow.
And your carbon footprint just exploded.
But I actually think, this is my thing about McDonald's. I think, and I will not name it by name, but the delis around here and a lot of shitty restaurants are not serving anything better than McDonald's. They're not.
That's true.
It's a compliment. It's an insult.
True.
The deli, the you're eating the roast beef.
Well, I don't eat that.
Is Boar's Head much better than a burger at McDonald's? I'm really proud to say
I have never been in a McDonald's in New York City. Okay, I mean, the only times I've ever been in a McDonald's in the last 30 years is like on the Indiana Turnpike when there's no other choice at 3 in the morning or something like this. I mean, there's so many reasons not to go to McDonald's. And number one is the food sucks. It's
kids
poison.
Kids like Happy Meals.
Kids like LSD. I don't give it to them either. You know,
are you buying your kids affection with like little toys?
Also, Mike Edison, like if the toy was like aged correctly, he would probably go to McDonald's. If it was like, if you got like 14 guitar picks with your Happy Meal, Mike Edison might like think about
this.
There
was a time in my life when I actually did send someone into a Burger King because I really wanted the Power Rangers watch, but I couldn't bring myself to go into those places. On so many levels, I find McDonald's and Burger King offensive. I mean, they're deforesting the planet. The food is terrible. They're poisoning America. It's a bad place, and I'm not going to. I don't like the argument that it's democratic because it's cheap and everybody can afford it. It's bad food. It makes me feel sick.
I'm actually saying most food is bad. Most food is bad.
Well, we talked about this last week. What is the percentage, Brandon, you and your, what percentage of food, what was the question that you eat do you think is excellent? Or is the food that you really want? How did you phrase it exactly?
I like it that it's excellent. You
I
guys answered it.
The
like, no, I mean, there's no way, you know, I didn't have only one way to answer it, but there was the
we
two
said,
ways.
We said, what percentage of food that you eat is truly excellent?
And we all agree it was over 80%, but we'll also include it in that, like,
Things you wanted.
You wanted a Big Mac and it's
bagel and cream
and
cheese.
It's satisfying. Well, that could be good food if you're getting a good bagel.
I was asking, like, of all the bagels, so you're eating a bagel, is it great? Is it one of the
versus
best?
Versus I said, I only choose to eat excellent food.
What sucks getting a bad bagel? And by the way, you live in New York fucking city. Again, this is the covenant of living in New York City. It's expensive to live here. And part of the deal is you don't have to eat bad bagels. That's what you're paying for.
And I think I think one part of the like collective wisdom of living here for a long time is that you start to, like, you can be at 80%. Like, once you've lived in New York long enough, you shouldn't be lower than 80%. That's a failure on your ability
to
go out and rate something.
Because why would I go to a McDonald's when I can get like an amazing falafel right around the corner?
I would say,
if I want something that's $3 and fast at 2 in the morning, there are so many options.
Because they don't deliver. I don't know the falafel place in my neighborhood that delivers.
But ask the Uber guy.
I'm mostly disappointed. I'm mostly disappointed when I'm being adventurous, right? When I'm like want to try some new things, that's usually when I'm disappointed. In my everyday life, I know what I like.
Right.
Like I go get the things that I like. That's one of the benefits of living in an urban environment.
Right. I agree.
That with myself all the time, like choose something new or go with an old steady, and then you know I usually make the new choice because you know that's the thing, and then I'm disappointed and angry at myself that I just didn't go with something I know I like.
But you know the rewards are high too, to be surprised, but you know it does suck to go to like a restaurant that's new or hyped or whatever. Someone said, hey, this is really great, and then you know, and then the gnocchi comes out, it's slimy, and you're like, what the fuck, you know, that's just wrong. That's a 12% that should be avoided.
Can you eat excellent at 80% if you're cooking at home? Have you got access to good enough fresh produce to be able to cook really well with that?
I mean, at home.
You guys know Patrick doesn't cook at home, right?
No, but do you
it
know
doesn't
what
sound
it
like
is?
Any of you do. I mean, it sounds like New York food culture is built around going out.
So if Ann makes a pasta.
Correct. I actually do. I probably eat the majority of my meals at home.
No, so
I'm
do we. A majority, of course. I mean, we go out a lot, but it's still a majority at home. But Ann, I said that 80% or what's great is. She makes 1,000 pastas in her life. Is this one of the best ones? Or did we make something new and it wasn't as good? Or we didn't try as hard? Or
Patrick,
we didn't duplicate how good it was last time for some reason? Or she put walnuts over it. We don't know why.
Patrick invited me over for dinner last week, and I showed up, and there was just a raw piece of salmon.
It was excellent quality.
It was great quality. I had the pin bones in there, so I was like, you know.
He's like, give me your wife's tweezers that she takes the hair out of her legs on, or your nose tweezer. And I was like, all right, I'll be right back. It's still there.
All right, but we fuck up dinner once in a while, but it's pretty rare. It's pretty rare if we're trying something new and it doesn't come out right or somehow screw it up. But, I mean, you've been cooking your whole life. I mean, how are you going to ruin a plate of pasta if you're starting with good? I mean, the only way to do it is to overcook it, really. It's the only way you're going to ruin something.
Well, sauces someone can not be great.
Well, if you're really
adventurous. This is coming from a man who doesn't have children. See, right. Things get ruined in my house because, like, I'm like, oh, shit. I've been, like, chasing these little assholes around. And then I'm like, holy shit, I forgot I had something in the oven. And then I'm like, motherfucker, there it goes. Just like that, just in an instant.
And then
this is where you then are like, now what do I have in this house to eat?
Yeah, frozen pizza, Roberta's pizza.
Right.
Ann says it's the most valuable thing in the fridge or freezer is Roberta's pizza.
Oh, money, I call that money in the bank.
Parents,
I always keep pizza in the freezer.
Need that. You need something to go to that is going to be, I can't be bothered to fight about food today, so I'm just going to feed you this and you'll eat it. And well, pasta is mine.
Sometimes I have a full cabinet full
of pasta because pasta is the best. Wait, for me, pasta is the go-to.
James and I were hanging out last night. You told me it was frozen fish sticks. You said that's your equivalent of calling delivery.
They live on an island. England's an island.
I wish.
They live in Devon.
My kids ate fish sticks for like 3 weeks, and I was so happy. I was like, this is a pathway to it. Like, even if it is, this is a pathway, and it just ended.
To mercury poisoning.
This particular, fish sticks is making me want to segue to this one. Did you ever learn anything gastronomically from your school lunch lady?
Yes, how to be a leader.
How to lead a
troop of people in the kitchen and to feed 400 kids.
I mean, she taught my stomach a bunch of gastronomical, there was this thing called a cheese zombie that was pretty amazing. Do you guys remember the cheese? Piece of bread that had like somehow injected, had a tube of yellow cheese inside of it.
I think Roberta should reinvent the cheese zombie. I think we need to go into the laboratory and work on this.
Yeah, cheese zombie.
I remember Friday was pizza day in my elementary school and the pizza would bounce. It was so rubbery, like literally like bounce on the table and the kids would like wing it against the table to see how high it would actually bounce.
Oh, we had like
about 6 inches, I think was the record. But
we had like French bread pizza. That was good.
We did too.
Stouffer's is French bread pizza. See, our lunch lady Thelma was so great that she made on her last day of working there chicken a la king, and we erased the king and put queen. Chicken a la queen.
First of all, this is such bullshit. There's zero chance that your lunch lady's name was Thelma.
It was.
You just literally made... This is so impossible. Well, were you born in the fucking 1910?
72.
Come on.
I swear to God, we dedicated our senior year yearbook to her, not predecessor, her, the person who followed her, successor.
Louise?
No.
I saw that movie.
My gosh.
Lunch lady. It's like one of those speeches Ronald Reagan used to give. And she's here right now. Stand up.
All right. Tell me a story. Tell me a real life story of the most gluttonous day of your life.
I was with you, Emily, in Vegas. You had eaten so much food. I think you just fell asleep at the table in Las Vegas. Cesare just got up. We thought he went to the bathroom. He literally took an Uber home to go to sleep. He just left. He didn't say goodbye to anyone.
There is something about Vegas that's just very gluttonous. And it's not, but it's not even the all you can eat buffet. It's just the abundance of, this like high roller kind of lifestyle that you want to lead, even if it's not your style.
Well, you're just trying to get all your money's worth, right?
Yeah, I remember your birthday party 1 year, Patrick, you had like 9 pounds of carne cruda. This is a starter.
I feel like
it was like going to Baskin Robbins, like these giant buckets of ice cream, except it was filled with raw meat.
That's not going to end well.
Every visit to Montreal is that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's weird about Montreal. It's kind of like that city, right?
Yeah, it's like French food for lumberjacks. So it's like rich on rich.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's great. Poutine, chips and gravy.
Yeah.
Foie gras, right?
Yeah, foie gras, everything. You order vegetables and they're like, oh, we put a little foie gras on it. Keep it light.
Well, yeah, I mean, the French are great at gluttony. Yeah. I mean, that's probably my... I went to Pierre Garnier in Paris about 10 years ago with my partner, and he's had 3 stars in Paris for 20 years. And you have, and it feels like the the last few days before the French Revolution kicks in, because you just have 18 courses, everything's got 15 elements, the whole table's filled with these little silver trays that have got bits on it, and it's so indulgent.
And if yours is high fidelity, mine would be low fidelity. Carlo and I went to Chicago for like a few hours, and all we did was eat, and it was we got off the plane and went to Fatso's, which is like a hot, and had like hot dogs and Lucy Juicy or Juicy Lucy's, and it was just progressively like it was gluttonous in the way that it was like everything you knew that they would probably give you a heart attack like on the flight back, and it was hours of just power eating like greasy spoon.
Awesome. Well, those nights too, Patrick, you see, let's go out to dinner and I don't realize it's going to involve four restaurants.
Every time my husband
Dennis joins us, he's like, I thought I was invited for one dinner. He's like, why is it number three?
Well, because we sell to 100 restaurants, 120 restaurants in New York and Brooklyn. And if you go,
Patrick's mentality is if we're night, out and if we started at 5, we may as well go till 9 and fit in 3.
And then
I agree.
We can't visit all those restaurants. I would like to visit those restaurants 2-3 times a year each, but you can't. That would be mean.
I pick a neighborhood and we say, what can we do within these?
What is the most successful food neighborhood in the world?
So tonight after Burano, where will you guys go?
I thought we'd go to Marlowe and Daughters first. They just put the Edward Suriano on their.
So we're going to try their submarine sandwich right before dinner.
That's where the gluttony starts. I could just ask for a little, you know, quarter of a pound sliced
but
thin.
But you
of
need to see how they're preparing it. You've had the Edward before.
You can really justify anything.
I can still support, take some pictures,
also,
try something else.
At what point do you say no to a submarine sandwich? Like, I just feel like, is there a part of the night where you're just like, that you've checked that off? Like, no more submarine sandwiches. For me, it's like, that goes until you fall asleep. Yeah, totally, until my refrigerator light burns out.
I remember speaking of Goat-tober, we went to Judge the Goat cook-off in South Carolina. Yeah. And this is Chris. We're visiting restaurants, and everybody, some are sales calls, and some are like people who are already buying heritage stuff who are making charcuterie. But everywhere we go, you know, Patrick, we're so glad to see you. And we just really stop in for a drink to say hello. And next thing you know, the charcuterie board comes out, the cheese board comes out. Here are some sliders. And this is happening. It's like we're up to about like 6 rounds of this before we get to like dinner at some old slave quarters, which is, you know, this magnificent thing that like, you know, like Thomas Jefferson would have served to his best friends. And when it's all over, Patrick wants to go to the drive-thru at McDonald's.
At that point, my stomach is open down there. It's just like a totally open chute.
I was at the Cheese Festival in Bra back in September, and that's a pretty gluttonous day.
Ooh, isn't that beautiful? Cheese is their nicest event.
Well, because you just, like,
you're in the
burrata,
medieval towns,
and
then,
yeah, and you spend every...
Everyone's so generous
and
with
the bra,
samples.
The, like, slimy bra. Oh, man, you could just do this forever.
The ones where you put the truffle roquefort in the thing, and, like...
Cheese is the lovely event.
What is
so
the
happy.
Slimy
We're going to ask you that.
I don't even know the name of it, but there's one that's there that's just like, it's just the gooeyest.
The brie.
It's not a brie, though. I don't even know. They tried to tell me what it was called.
Gorgonzola that just melts and they shave
like
truffles into it.
Yeah.
Totally.
All right. Well, you're obviously both going to die because you're eating unhealthily. So in your our next question, in your obituary, after the first paragraph that says your name, how old you were, and cause of death, what will the second paragraph
say? That's a bad obituary writer because I need a better lead.
You say that Mike Edison.
Okay, whatever your lead-in is, after that first lead-in paragraph.
Which I'm still working on.
What's the second one going to say?
That's the second paragraph is the one where they, for the first time, explain who the hell you are and what you did. It's your greatest accomplishment.
Like he shot Kennedy?
Yes.
I didn't.
Mine's going to lead in with the cause of death and then go, and he didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I was going to say mine was going to be like, and his heart exploded like a nuclear bomb.
Yeah. But what a party.
Emily had a very nice answer. You told me what you were going to say for this one.
I told you yesterday. Mine's going to say she'll talk to anyone, especially strangers. But I didn't.
In airport bars.
That's nice. That's a nice quality.
Certainly.
And that's what got her abducted in that van.
That's why she died.
Oh, that was
what crazy. About you, James? I mean, it'll be wrapped up with the goat. Did you ever think this growing up?
No. I said to him, we talked about this yesterday, and I said, the soppy sentimental side of me says father to Mika and Elwood. Right, and then after that,
affectionately known as Goat Man, probably.
The Goat Man. The in the New York Times, the where they lived and who they left behind is always at the end. And the only the New York Times says the cause of death in the first paragraph. Like CNN, when you're looking at that, they don't say the cause of death. Which
trampled
is kind
to death
of what,
by goats.
Yeah, well. Exactly. Payback. Yeah.
Are you going to go Egyptian and like have 200 goats with you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, goat sarcophagus. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting.
March into the afterlife with a squad.
Most people don't think of legacy while they're living. They're just living their life to the max and having the most fun. But it is interesting.
Besides how you, yeah. You're obviously live a life of legacy.
I'm
going to
remember that forever.
Like, this is, you live your life based on the idea of legacy.
I'm going to remember that forever.
Do you own a funeral plot? Does anybody own a funeral plot here?
No, I'm getting myself cremated. I'm not taking up land.
Emily's thinking of place. Interesting.
Do you?
No, but Greenwood Cemetery is more affordable than you might think.
She's got like the most expensive Travazo, like headpiece, like or like marble,
a mausoleum.
I'm thinking obelisk. Speaking of ancient Egyptian, yeah, fuck yeah.
If so, you own a funeral plot, do you have to wait till you're dead to occupy it, or is this the new Brooklyn housing trend? It's like turns out very affordable sarcophagus, beautiful views. You know.
So my parents both have plots that because my father's parents have a plot and there's two more spaces. But yeah, nobody's doing that anymore.
I think the most unecological thing in the world is to take a piece of land forever.
She's Jewish. They got a deal. It was like a Groupon.
You're standing up.
For the price of two, we'll take it.
My mom, she had it bought a long time ago. Probably
funny you should
discount.
Say that. My dad's not Jewish, so I bet maybe they don't even allow Jews. Maybe my mom's not even allowed. Shit.
But no, I think it's a thing definitely of a certain generation
where you
buy those
black tie
plots at a time. But yeah.
Do you have a plot?
Do I have one? No, yeah. I think Greenwood Cemetery is more for
cremate yourself. Give me. You have to saddle people with like a samovar of your ashes that they have to carry around with them whenever they
James,
move.
What about in
a
England?
Samovar.
Do most families have... Nice. Do most families have cemetery plots?
No. I mean, all the old churches have really old gravestones in the sort of...
Can you still bury someone in a church in England?
Yeah, I think so. I think
in Italy you can.
You have to be important.
But most
I love where Winston Churchill was buried, just in his backyard.
I didn't know that.
Very humble.
Have you already requested that Turner Towers leave a little plot for you?
No, I'm going to give everybody a little piece of my ashes, so I'll kind of like be around.
My father wanted
He's like, I'm just going to hide. I'm going to have my wife hide my body in the boiler room.
My father wanted to be buried at Bloomingdale, so my mother would visit him.
Cryogenics.
Yeah. Yeah, one of those buttons.
I don't know what I did.
That is sad horn for that one. Sad horn.
Patrick, maybe you were like, instead of being buried, you could do a final Instagram post.
What happens to Instagram 100 years after someone dies?
I don't know. You want to see my Facebook page?
You can
my MySpace page?
You can memorialize.
Even
Facebook.
Better, you want to see my live journal?
You can memorialize Facebook pages once someone passes away. I don't know about Instagram.
Well, by the way, Danny Meyer likened social media to a cross between the town square of times past and a postcard. What does Instagram in particular mean to each of you and your businesses? That's a question.
That's a question that obviously nobody wants to answer. Everyone
it's
was
too
like,
serious.
Yeah, they're like, oh, we were having fun.
You love Instagram. No, Brandon, Roberta's has a huge following, right?
I mean, we use Instagram. And so, I mean, hey, it's just a promotional tool these days. It's just another way to, hey, when I was young and a bartender and a DJ and had bands, we used to make flyers and give them out. And guess what? Now I don't got to waste all that paper and sit around at Kinko's for fucking 4 hours. So what is it to me? It's Kinko's.
But the question is, though, is your social media game better because of all the shit we learned when we had to mimeograph stuff and go around like pasting it or, you know, gluing it to walls and
stuff?
Well,
you can answer that. There's no doubt that my Instagram game is better because I had to do it manually
for so many years.
Gluing it to walls. Wow, that's basically what it
was. A bucket of paste? I mean, that's how he promoted gigs. Playing at CBGB's next Friday. And you'd make a flyer and you'd cut it and paste it. And there were, you know, when there were scissors and scotch tape or rubber cement involved.
I went down
to the copy shop.
I should you not.
Them had a bucket of tape. Like, what paste?
The Kinko's at Astor Place, I would sit there for hours.
Yeah.
I would sit in the fucking Kinko's cutting shit up, putting it, taping it together, photocopying.
Yep. When
I'd run around, hand it out, stick it to shit.
Yep.
And like,
that's how you had to promote a gig. Absolutely.
These kids today, they'll never know the struggle. They'll never know.
Is that per pound more effective because there was less of it? Now, Instagram is, there's an avalanche of information. Was what you did, going sticking those bills to those walls, better in terms of hit rate?
I'll tell you, it's exactly the same.
My click through on my flyers.
I'll tell you, it's almost exactly the same. The more productive you are, Mike and I went out and did this. Not every band was good at this part of it either. So it's kind of almost the same. It's like there's a little bit of Darwinism in it where you're just like, if you're good at doing this, people will come see your band.
And you're
if
sat
you make
here
good
with
flyers,
no Grammys.
And you have a good.
You're sat here with no Grammys. So I guess it's not that.
No, this is true.
There should be Grammy awards for flyers.
If there was, Mike and I would be definitely.
Lifetime Achievement Award for Mimeograph Flyers.
Well, the only.
Bucket of paste.
Yeah.
I think it goes to this like mom and pop local idea. The flyer was only going to get you so much.
I'm promoting a local gig, but it's working for me on Facebook. It is working. I'm promoting local ads. I'm targeting my ads. Hyper local. We had a great event this week. The place was packed out. Hopefully, I'm going to be at Quimby's in Williamsburg Sunday night. And the ad is only targeted to 180 people because they're the only people who live, close enough that we're actually going to come to this event versus an event in Manhattan next week where I'm targeting a different 300 people.
Because Facebook knows everything about you.
Hey, Brandon, this is a fascinating thing about, look, I just read in the Times. They said between the NFL, the NBA, and baseball kicks all their asses so much in terms of viewership and TV and ticket sales because of how many games they are and how strong locally. Baseball games are always the highest rated thing locally within a region. It's just you can't name any players for the Seattle Mariners, but that doesn't matter because in Seattle and around Seattle,
it's a volume play, Patrick. You know this. It's a volume play. How many baseball games do they play?
But it's very local. It's where local kicks ass.
There's more baseball teams than there are either one of those other sports.
I'm sorry about Kershaw.
No,
I'm sorry.
Like a dagger to the, like you're you
I
you
like brought them.
You see this question came up so
them.
You can
no,
like
my Yankees
slice
yeah. I was about to say right. Shouldn't we say I'm right. Sorry about the Yankees World yeah. Series is on yeah. With no he, Yankees
he
there
low, he took a low blow but that's all right you know
are there more mom and pop since Emily brought that up more mom and pop businesses in England than there are in the U.S. is everything mom and pop there
I don't know there is I wouldn't say so. I mean, it feels like that sort of mum and pop Midwest business tradition is much stronger than it is in the UK. Like London is an island. Everything inside the M25 is now considered.
But no, in the rest of England, is it franchises?
Yeah, what's the Walgreens of?
Walmart, yeah. Walgreens.
Walmart have bought Asda, which is one of our supermarkets. So you have Tesco. I mean, they dominate. Large supermarkets dominate the food system in the UK as much as they do in the US.
I see.
I think the way that is changing is that, kind of as a reaction to that, people that have worked in food their whole lives, chefs like me, I mean, I'm a good example of it, become a producer, found a specialist product. And that, I think, is going to have a pretty profound influence on the food system in the UK over the next 20 years.
That's the same thing here. That's pretty much what's happening here as well. I think pretty everywhere, that's like the one way that you can influence the more national, as Patrick would put it, food system.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my theory is that if we look over the large span of food production, like over the next 100, 200 years, the period between the end of the Second World War and now will be seen as the anomaly. And I think that the pushback against that large sort of industrial food complex is starting to happen.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, well, that's what slow food's for. I mean, we talk about that a lot, and there are other. I think that's one of the things that chefs can do in a food system is support small producers who are doing things the right way, and that will eventually allow them to grow and expand, which is what's happened to you and what's happened to us.
So what's up with cheese? You were at the largest international event for cheese. Yeah. Is it how would you rate the event? Describe
it
to
cheesy.
People. Oh, really?
It's difficult to describe. I guess, it's the scale of it is probably like the equivalent of shutting down Bushwick.
and lining every street with a cheese producer from all over the world. So there was lots of guys from Vermont there we went and said hello to. There's all the British cheeses represented. There's an entire tent of Italian cheese, there's an entire tent of French cheese, and then up at the top of the town they have the beer and the wine tasting and some food vendors.
And you
so
told me
no tent full of American cheese.
Yeah.
They have like circus sized tents.
Yeah, but what they had was like they'd obviously got like a cooperative of cheese makers.
Government
together.
Cheese.
I think there was like 10, maybe 15 different cheese producers, but they're all from New England.
And then you told me you were the only meat.
The dinner that we did was the first time that anyone at the cheese festival had acknowledged the fact that the billy goats are a consequence of the cheese production.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, we helped connect that. I feel so honored to be the thing. I mean, Carlo Petrini, he cares, man. If there's a good cause, he will give it its moment.
So it was at
I love it.
It was at the university in one of their sort of grand halls, and we worked with a shop called The Fromagerie, which has a little cafe, which is based in Marylebone in London, and we teamed up with them. So they did half the menu, we did half the menu. And James
brought a goat on the train. He traveled by train so that
I carried
he could,
a goat on the train from,
so he could bring
from
meat.
Devon to Turin.
Wow.
So guys, before we go to the interview part, most interesting neighborhood in the world, a single neighborhood, and it's not, you can't say like the Eastern Seaboard or the American West. Well, single neighborhood.
That's a really tough question.
I know, that's why we asked it.
But I was in Melbourne in February, March, and right in the middle of the central business district is Chinatown. And you're just walking through what looks like downtown Melbourne, you turn right, and suddenly you're in Sichuan food heaven. And that was what I thought.
I do gotta say, I do love Chinatown to the various American cities. I love Chinatown in San Francisco. I try to eat as often as I can in Chinatown, in Manhattan. Yeah, I don't know. Everything's shifting so much, but at least there, I don't know. There's obviously an exotic nature to it. Like, I mean, look at Bushwick. I mean, this was a town that was like burned to the ground 30 years ago, and it's like, you know, thriving.
There's like 300 restaurants.
You know, every time I come, the graffiti outside Roberta's is different. It's a pretty interesting neighborhood. I mean, but everything shifts. I mean, Greenwich Village used to be a very interesting neighborhood. Now, not so much.
Well, we sell to about half of our business in New York happens between Houston and 14th. 10th and 3rd.
This also depends on your take on interesting.
Right.
Are you talking about like sophistication? Are you talking like Harajuku is a very interesting neighborhood. I don't know if it's my cup of tea, but nobody's going to say that it's not an interesting neighborhood.
No, you could say Little Egypt in Queens.
Right.
I mean, I saw an article, the headline this morning that all the new developments in Flushing are ruining all the street food vendors. But that used to be something that people would just go just to eat from street carts. So I don't know. We could say Chelsea Market or the Boqueria in Barcelona.
Yeah, but those are neighborhoods. Those are destination spots.
No, excuse
me.
But she's saying the destination is so good that you would say the neighborhood.
I mean, they're great.
So you're saying the Meatpacking District is your choice?
That would be a great one. That would be a very good one to say.
It has... No, I don't like all like the big clubby steakhouse.
Well, years ago it was a little.
You don't like cocaine.
Do you remember when like Rio Mar was? Yeah.
I love it.
When
cocaine? Did you say cocaine and fish?
Yeah. Welcome to the Meatpacking District.
Yeah, but do you remember when Rio Mar was right at the corner of like Gonzalez and Little West 12th Street, and
what?
That was like
Pasties
the
came back.
That was like the date place. That was like where we used to go like you take a girl out dinner, it was like $30 for like two for mussels.
$30.
Laurent.
Okay, I'm going to embarrass you, who was president back in those days.
The tunnel.
Okay. But that was a place, and there was nothing else around. There was no Pasties. Stella McCartney had yet to have been invented. You know, I mean, it was...
There was Florent. Florent was that steakhouse. 4 a.m, you get a steak.
Patrick.
He closed.
Yours is Upper East, right?
I would easily... York first. It's so good. Germantown.
York is like a food desert.
Well, no, they have Schaller and Weber. That was an old German thing. If you like schnitzel... You want to be on the Upper East Side by where the mayor lives.
Oh, yeah. Gracie Mansion, that hotbed of activity.
Who doesn't love
All right,
Germany?
Wait.
By the way, Upper West Side was kind of, I think, older
I
money
just said
didn't
Zabar's.
Attract good
that,
restaurants.
That's a very, it's a very interesting neighborhood, the Upper West Side. Moscow on the Hudson, as it's known, because there were so many.
How far west are you going?
I'm talking about uptown and then the upper 80s, because it was notoriously liberal, bordering a communist neighborhood.
I'm going to say Zabar's final answer. Also, the Boat Bays and Cafe officially
Zabar's
closed.
Zabar's is not a neighborhood.
Yes, it is. I'm allowed
what are these
to say
Zabar's what are these is not neighborhoods? I don't understand your neighborhoods. Chelsea Markets and Zabar's. These are not neighborhoods. These are places in a neighborhood.
Why can't I pick a single
McDonald's, Flushing and Flatbush.
Chelsea is a neighborhood, and we like it because of and Chelsea Market.
No, she's saying
I'm picking
that it's
a micro. No, a micro neighborhood.
You're saying that store is so important.
A retail venue.
But what makes a neighborhood good would be multiple locations.
I think I've spent too much time with Patrick. I went to the micro neighborhood. One store.
But I think we're all agreed, though, that the thing that links all of this is it's the immigrant food that makes it interesting.
Yeah, that's true. Diversity, difference. Yeah, for sure.
Yes, Daniel.
I like immigrants.
What else do you want to... You can throw me. You can really throw me down under the bus.
The show is getting so liberal.
I like immigrants.
Yeah. All right, we have to take a very quick break. Hear from our sponsors. Stick around. We'll be back with more of Goat-tober and liberal immigrant food.
This episode is supported by Bon Bon, a charming neighborhood bistro in Lawrence, Kansas, serving eclectic cuisine with Midwest roots. Bon Bon is a place for friends and neighbors to come together and enjoy good food, good drinks, and good company. The heart of Bon Bon is filled with love for the community of Lawrence, Kansas, for the staff and suppliers that put food on the table, for quality local ingredients, and for fun, creative dishes. Learn more at bonbonlawrence.com. Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th, for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Join us to explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, where you'll taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Join the party. Tickets are available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
East Williamsburg.
Where have you been?
East Williamsburg, also here in far west Zabars.
I liked Zabar Heights. That was a classic.
That would be the housewares section. All right. Well, yeah. I have to remind you all, we have Daniel Sharp of the Meatball Shop here with us and James Wetlore of Cabrito Goat Meat.
Hello. Hi.
But they both fit in so perfectly that they should, we would love to have you both as regular co-hosts.
You can fly me over whenever you want. All right. I'm happy to come.
I could only afford the property here at Western Roberta's. but I've been really looking. Here's the great school system you have here.
I think
Roberta's Gardens.
There's room for a meatball shop on the corner. You could be Northwest Roberta's corner.
They have some estate already, correct? Well, yeah, we have some neighborhoods.
Meatball Town.
All right, James,
yes.
Tell us about Goat-tober 2019. You have, we are sort of approaching the end. I mean, you know,
yeah,
a couple
it's
minutes.
Been a, it's been a long month. I think I've been home twice this month. And the first day I arrived in New York was the first day I hadn't had goat for dinner in like 30.
So I asked him what he had for dinner and he said nothing.
Just had nothing for dinner.
Bastard.
I went to J.J. Johnson's rice bowl, had the vegan stuff there and had nothing for dinner because I was just like totally goated out. So it started, as we were talking about a minute ago, we started at the Cheese Festival, which is like pre-Goat-tober. And then we've had events all over the UK and we've had events in London. We had the launch night in London. And then I've been in France and the Netherlands and Ireland. And the stuff in France is quite exciting because they, you know, they have a lot of goats going in a hole in the ground. So we've started to work with InterBev, who are their large overarching sort of union that promote French farming. So we're working with them, try and kickstart Goat-tober in France.
So what's your tagline? What's your tagline? So someone's like, what do you do? And you're like, Goat-tober. They're like, what the hell is that? And you're in France or you're in Trinidad. What do you say?
It's a month-long celebration. It's a global month-long celebration of goat meat with the goal of putting all of the dairy billies born into the dairy system all over the world, into the food system. But the beauty of the Goat-tober message is that people have been able to pick it up and turn it into the thing that they want it to be. So we've been working in Australia where they're looking to try and get a domestic goat meat market going. The MLA, who are again like InterBev, large overarching union, are going to use Goat-tober to try and generate some interest in goat in their domestic market because they export a lot, but they don't eat very much in.
Apparently in Australia, all they do is they freeze the whole goats and then they dice them up with the bones in it and they ship it to like the Caribbean, that's to crazy. Trinidad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They don't
The Australians export more goat meat than anyone else.
In the nonprofit mission, or is your business trying to find entrepreneurs who are going to launch goat businesses?
Because it's growing so quickly, that stuff is we're still trying to define. But it feels to me like in the longer term, Goat-tober will be a not-for-profit. I mean, hopefully we'll be able to generate... For next year, we're going to try and find a global sponsor. And then hopefully we'll be able to do, as you said, be able to distribute some money to goat projects in the... The example that we can use is Trinidad. So last week I was in Trinidad doing Goat-tober TT, which is run by a woman called Franca Phillip, who wants to use Goat-tober to encourage Trinidad farmers to rear goats in Trinidad and put them into the domestic market. Trinidad's an island of 1.4 million people. It's the ninth biggest consumer of goat meat in the world. I mean, that's an incredible statistic on its face, but they import 90% of it.
Wow.
If we can use Goat-tober to encourage farmers to grow goats in the domestic market, it's $100 million a year US market. So even if we can change it by 10%, you'll be putting $10 million US into Trinidad farmers' pockets. And that would make an extraordinary difference to their lives.
I do think Goat-tober just implies that it's one time a year versus all year, because that's like an economy change over there, if all the little farmers...
Sorry, I had to wake Mike up. He was falling asleep.
Well, I'm just thinking that if you buy a man a goat, you could feed him for a day, but if you teach a man to goat...
There's a tagline. What we say in Trinidad is, why are you paying an Australian farmer when you can pay a Trinidad one? And that feels to me, and the reason that I'm so excited about the Trinidad thing is that feels like a very heritage thing to do. Support small local farmers to get better at growing their product and sell it into a different market.
It's nice to have projects on the islands.
Well, there is that, but you know.
I told him he looked a little tan.
It is ironic. It's so English of you to colonize the island. We're like, they already have a billion goats. They're eating goats. Everything's fine with goats.
Do you know,
and you're like, we got them.
There is definitely, and I'm very aware of this. It's very much a sensitivity. White guy turn up, tell black people what to do. And that is a sensitivity that I'm very aware of. The thing about the project there is the project's basically four women. And that is a great thing, I think, for the island to have those four women that are running this project. And when we took a chef over to, because we took James Cochran over to Trinidad to do some dinners, I found a young black chef with some Jamaica St. Vincent heritage, because I didn't want to, you know, white guy flies in white guy to island full of black people to tell them how to do it. I wanted it to have a certain amount of
That's very progressive of you.
A little hangover from the patriarchal British Empire.
Totally. Guilt, man. Guilt. But it has to be that way, I think.
I have a question. What do you think the best bet for getting Americans to eat goat is? Like, is it
put it in front of them, get them to eat it, and they're
like a burger,
delicious.
But I mean, is it like, do you, you know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we thought about this a lot, obviously.
Irony.
It's a good source of iron.
I think, well, there is that, yeah, I mean, there is the health aspect of it. It's really lean, mm-hmm. It's high in protein, it's high in iron, it's quite good for you. But yeah, we should just have that on constant.
Yeah. Every time Patrick speaks.
The best way to convince Americans about goat is irony.
So, I make seriously badass goat chili, and it is always, people always say, like, holy cow, this is, holy cow, whatever. But people are like, wow, this is great. You know, I mean, it's because it's, you know, the meat brings a lot of flavor.
It's a catch-22, right? It's because you can't cook a product that doesn't exist, but then it's really hard to get the farmers to raise enough animals in order to get to that sort of critical mass where you could do a meatball and be happy with it all year round, knowing the supply was good, and we're just knowing it.
I feel like we just figured it out. If everyone just starts saying holy goat instead of holy cow, we're just going to change the perception, and there we go.
Greatest thing on the station of all time. That's the greatest of all time.
That has made it. You were talking about Instagram earlier on.
Yeah.
Goat becoming the greatest of all time thing has meant that there are memes and Instagram things that I can use to promote all the
time. So can I pretend I'm with a legitimate newspaper right here and that this was like a hardcore media source? What is the most impressive result you've achieved? I guess I'm thinking legal. Like, what is your single greatest achievement, I guess, through government or change or a major company changing its ways? Or, I mean,
two things. Yeah. One, and they're farm-based. They're not, because the business has two.
No problem.
There's the one that's on the farm, and there's the stuff that it gets all the press, which is the putting it on the posh restaurants. I go onto a farm. There's two farms, right? I go onto these two farms, and there are new kid sheds that have been put up because of Cabrito. So we have, that is a real sort of bricks and mortar achievement. That kid shed exists because of Cabrito. Mm-hmm. There, and the, I think, but the biggest achievement of ours, I think, is the second biggest goat farm in the UK is run by a guy called Will Frost. He's the first first commercial dairy herd of any size, over 2,500 milking nannies, to not euthanize any billies. So of all the press and the book and all that stuff, that is a real concrete achievement that nobody knows about.
Hey, good for you. It all started in this station in a way. And Aaron sitting here talking together. This was a real nexus of ideas. And we're just in the food example. What are those guys who had that leather outfit making place for the movie stars biking, and those leather guys, those fashion guys who were here in the early years? The Death Killers. Yeah, them. There were all these.
I don't know where this is going.
This is all these ideas germinated in a weird way.
But I think one of the things that this made Goatoba work is the fact that it doesn't have any really strict boundaries on it. So people have picked it up and been able to stretch it into the thing that they want it to be. That's worked really well in Trinidad. It's going to work in Australia.
Well, and I think that timing and Instagram and branding and social media and this ability to not just have posters locally, but to have people be able to tag things. You know,
I'm not going all over France pasting goat posters all over France. Isn't
that right? I think that
who makes their pajamas? This is what I want to know.
Whose pajamas?
The goats.
This is calling upon an earlier comment Mike made at the beginning of the show.
That's an internet meme. Goats in pajamas, goats in trampolines, goats on trees.
Goats make good cashmere. And James gives all of his hides to a tannery.
Don't look back in Angora.
Thanks. You've ended the show in silence.
I couldn't even get to the button fast enough. I was paralyzed by that comment.
Silence. All right, I hope you will all join us tonight at Burano, October 24th. Tomorrow at Saxelby Cheesemongers, October 25th. Daniel Sharp, who is here with us right now, is providing the goat meatballs. Maybe they're going to stay on the menu at the meatball shop all year round if they're successful enough.
I'm excited. I really am. I think goat is delicious.
And we hope you'll all follow Goatober News. James is at Cabrito Goat Meat on Instagram and Goatober.com. There will be happenings, you know, year-round, especially, obviously, during October.
What?
I don't know. Are we sharing memes?
Patrick Brown are like passing notes in class. Do something, Emily. Make it
all
stop.
Right. I don't know. I'll work on it. Stick around for a taste of the past. And
can't wait. Zabar's coming to Trinidad soon.
Exactly. And
a taste of the past makes it sound like it's always a rerun.
You're right. And next week is Halloween. Is everyone going to dress up in the studio?
All right. Let me tell you something.
I have a mask.
Next week is...
Take it off.
Thursday, October 31st.
I'll tell you something. We're doing a Halloween show because we should do a Halloween show.
We're doing a Halloween show, and our guests are the owners
from
the Dead Rabbit.
Scary.
Cocktail bar.
Scary.
I tell you what, though. I love Halloween. I love giving out the candy, but no costume, no candy. I got hardcore.
Every time Sharp
rules.
Is on, he pretty much, I would say, talks closest to the least and yet gets two of the biggest laughs. He always hits it. It's
amazing.
You give
out meatballs in Halloween?
Two home
great.
Runs a game.
You know,
it's amazing. He did it again this week. I didn't even announce it because I was like, if it doesn't happen today, it'll make him feel uncomfortable. But he did it again.
Sometimes less is more.
Yeah.
Sometimes less is more.
The real goat.
Exactly. Daniel Sharp, the real goat. All right. Thanks so much, guys. See you next week. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.